The name of our podcast, Tech Sequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives.
I'm Leslie Daigle. Welcome to Tech Sequences. Alexa is unable to join us today, but we'll be back at it together soon. The internet as we know it exists because of the development of open standards for internet working telecommunications and the applications and services that run on top of it. While those were initially developed under the auspices of government research funding, the real expansion of the internet took off when private firms started participating in the early 1990s. Today, it is fair to say that the only reason we have global networks and services is because private companies have built them and operate them. At the same time, the internet continues to provide the basis for innovation and service development around the globe to the extent it still relies on open standards, interoperability, and collaboration. In 2016, today's guest wrote, "Historically, these attributes have required private actors to leave the comfort zone of traditional telecommunications and embrace a regulatory environment that encourages change and innovation. But market forces emerging with new technologies are challenging these foundations with potentially dire consequences for the continued openness of the internet." 4 years later, things are hardly any less challenging, so let's discuss. My guest for today is Patrick Feldstrom, who has been involved in internet-related standardization work since 1989. He is currently the technical director and head of security at the Swedish firm Netnod, and he has worked for large and small companies in Sweden, the US, and Canada. Patrick has been active in the Internet Engineering Task Force, was an area director for applications area for 5 years, followed by 3 years on the Internet Architecture Board, and 3 years on the board of the Internet Society from 2006 to 2009. He has been a member of the ICANN Security and Stability Advisory Committee since 2007 and its chairman from 2011 to 2017. He was an advisor to the Minister of IT in Sweden from 2003 to 2011 and has been an advisor or board member in a number of organizations and investigations over the years, both in public and private organizations. In January 2011, Patrick received the award, the Order of the Cross of Terra Mariana, 5th class, by the President of Estonia. Welcome, Patrick.
Thank you very much.
Wow. You've been up to a lot of stuff since we worked together in the early days.
Well, you get older and the CV grows longer. That happens.
It does. And I should say that, so Archie, the first search engine for the internet, celebrated its 30th birthday recently. And you and I first met at Bunyip Information Systems, which was founded in 1992, shortly after the first commercial traffic was allowed on the internet and was the home of Archie.
That is correct. And I joined Bunyip in 1995 and worked with the very successful NOT WHOIS++ protocol, which was one of those open standards that we're going to talk about more today. And I think we should remember that standards themselves act as products on the market. And we have competition not only between products, but also between standards and also to some degree standards organizations. So given that we're living in a market economy, there is always a choice. And this is what you recited from, something that I find very interesting, the balance between openness and follow standards and participate in standardization, where organizations by definition have to work together with their competitors.
So let's take a step back and just look at, first of all, why do you think standards and particularly open standards are important? And maybe tell people a little bit about what they are and are not.
I think we have to look back into the success of the internet compared to telecommunication as we now work within this sector. And that is the sector that we know something about. The traditional telecommunication, we have development of services like pipes. If you want to provide a service, you actually provide everything that is needed to be able to deliver that service to a customer. And if you are two competitors, you have one pipe each. The whole value chain, you took care of everything. You know, on the internet architecture is the other way around. We instead have horizontal layers, which means that you have something that is very much, all analogies are bad, but let's say that we have roads and every car manufacturer can make a car that runs on the same road, as long as you agree on, for example, the maximum width of cars and such things. So you have certain agreements that enables the competition and development of cars and roads. And the same thing with the internet, that we have these horizontal layers in the value chain. We had copper wires, we have fiber, we have radio links, we have some kind of medium on which we can have a transport, and then on top of that we can have IP packets, and then on top of IP packets we have various protocols, and the protocols themselves might carry other kind of things. So the reason why this internet works is that by agreeing on, for example, how to ship IP packets and what the IP packets look like, all of us can implement either interoperable or non-interoperable applications on top of IP. So we all need certain agreements to then be able to compete. We need to have certain agreements to be able to innovate. We need to be able to cooperate in some ways to be able to have service differentiation. So, and this is where everything becomes interesting, because as you said, it's the private sector that has done the innovation and investments in telecommunication, and what is needed are decisions that each investment have to make on where to what to collaborate on and what to compete on, and where that division line goes might differ over time as well.
So, and I think we should talk separately about internet infrastructure itself. And then possibly touch on applications as well, because applications are effectively what most people think of when they think of the internet. But I mean, in the early 2000s, the real question was how to get more internet everywhere, how to get broadband everywhere, and how to do that in a way that, you know, was building out the road for everyone to use, even though it might be private companies that were building it out. Now, I know you know a little bit about how that played out in Sweden. Any thoughts about how that worked out, how well that worked out, or how it didn't work out?
I think what we all agree on, we use internet or the internet architecture, is that the IP layer, IP version 4 and now IPv version 6, that's the layer that is the common part of the architecture. It has always been so. Then both below and above, we have differentiation. And this is why some people talk about an hourglass model. So how that shaped up? Well, to be able to build out efficient IP transport, for example, all over Sweden, that is something we need to agree on, for example, how to handle the physical infrastructure to minimize the investments and make that as efficient as possible. But let's talk about that later. Regarding the IP layer itself, that is something that in Sweden worked out pretty well, because of the disagreements of what protocol to use, X25, DECnet, various source versions and IP, because of the disagreements, specifically in the universities in the 1980s, in the Nordic country ministers, the countries in the Nordic, Sweden, Norway, Finland, and Iceland, Denmark, decided to have a multi-protocol network. So the Swedish university network in Sweden originally was not only IP. There were multiple protocols that was possible to be carried in parallel. And over time, the other protocols actually went away. And it's not only like since mid-1990s that it was clear that IP would win.
So you say the other protocols went away, and that was because market forces basically dictated or demonstrated that IP was successful in more ways than the previous protocols.
Yes, just like, for example, electronic mail, where we had X400 as email system, also in the Swedish administration, all the way until Y2K came. And there were so many the software packages that were popularly used for X400 did not handle the Y2K issues. So ultimately, those systems were shut down. But also, not only if you look globally in the country, if you also look locally in offices, you had AppleTalk and you had various SNA and various other protocols that you were using locally. But now those are also replaced with IP. So one thing that I think is kind of interesting, that when you have young people, the ones that actually make sure things happen regarding innovation, they think it's really scary to have both IPv4 and IPv6 in the same network. And they're like, we who lived in 1995, we remember having, I don't know how many protocols in parallel. So it took actually me personally a while to understand why some people were scared over IPv6. Because that thing by having multiple protocols in parallel, we have to remember that was it was only for let's say for a very, very few years when we in reality, in practice, only had IPv4. Before that, we had many protocols in parallel, and after, now we have two.
And we'll have two for a while, I think.
It looks like it, specifically in countries like Sweden, which is very, very slow on IPv6 adoption.
Well, yeah, but at this point, it's better that we have two for a while than we try to make do with the old one and fail to deploy IPv6. But I'm getting into a different topic. Or maybe it's the same topic.
Well, it's a similar topic, because I think what is important here is to understand that we have agreed that we should use this as a common carrier for applications and services. And what is now happening, you will see that on many, many services, that instead of implementing various protocols like WHOIS++, what people do instead is that they see that, wait a second, the protocol actually consists of two portions. One is the actual data abstraction and syntax for the data. And the second one is to carry the data. And what people understand is that it's actually pretty damn easy to pass the data and transfer the data over HTTP. So we have the transfer protocols, which is HTTP, and then the HTTP over TLS, and then we have QUIC. So we have that kind of evolution of a higher layer transport protocol mechanism for applications. And then we have a separate evolution of the applications themselves. And that's why we have so many REST interfaces, and I don't know how many things that runs on top of HTTP. So that has become sort of a common denominator for the application layer. Earlier, we only had IP.
So now we're moving into the whole space of applications and services. And in your 2016 paper, your concluding paragraph included, the market forces that favor service-oriented vertical integration over disintermediated open interface create strong economic incentives for individual companies to build silos with APIs rather than interoperable devices that implement standard protocols. Do you think that's still true, or what do you think has changed in the years since?
I think it's absolutely true. And unfortunately, I think that we're still going in the wrong direction there. Yes, we are doing things over HTTP, but if I look back to my time as area director, one of the most difficult situations we had was when we looked at calendaring. And many of us actually do have a headache when we think about calendaring and calendar objects. But what we decided in those days was a syntax for the calendar object. And then we passed it around over electronic mail. So we used electronic mail as the carrier for the calendar object. And because of that, we can actually invite each other to events. But we should remember that in those discussions, there were many companies that did calendaring software that absolutely refused and were against the IETF coming up with a common standard for the syntax for objects, because they wanted to sell both the server and the client side. Because when they were doing their procurement, there were so few players on the market. So they were hoping that they could sell to NetNode, for example, a calendaring server, and then that way they could sell also the clients to create a silo. So from a market economy standpoint, there's still interest of doing silos. And we see that today still regarding all of these now, all the systems that are moving into the cloud, that people have APIs. Sure, you can use APIs to access documents and data storage and whatever it is, but it's a different API for each one of the, for example, cloud services that there is. So we unfortunately, we still see quite a lot of silos.
Yeah, so I think everybody who's lived through the recent months of COVID-19 pandemic lockdown and various forms and working from home recognizes that there are many different silos of video conferencing software, for example. You can probably all name the top half dozen without breaking a sweat. But that caused somebody I know recently to remark, you know, in all these movies like Star Trek and whatever, when different people from different races who've never met before, you know, different groups from in the stars come together, they never have troubles communicating. And
they all speak English.
Well, no. The Universal Translator takes care of that.
Oh, yeah, the Babelfish. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So, but I mean, it is a good point about how, to your point, about how video services are very different because they have been built as silos than really email was. And email was once X400 failed to pass the year 2000.
Yes, that is true. That said, what we do see now because of the pandemic, and a lot of people have this issue with interoperability, I see an uptake in the IETF standards for video conferencing, which is named WebRTC. So maybe this COVID-19 will do for video conferencing, just like Y2K for X400. It will make all the applications that runs 8323 or proprietary solutions and where you need plugins in your web browser and whatnot, it will simply just make them obsolete, because as a company, I just cannot have every system on video conferencing in the conference room where I'm currently sitting. My system, I want to be able to, from the video conference system that I invested in, I want to be able to do video conferencing with everyone else. So, but this is also where market economy comes in. The customers must request and prefer systems which can communicate not only within the silo, but also with other silos. Because I claim the first step is to be able to communicate between silos. And then the silo manufacturers will detect, oh shit, it's actually cheaper and more efficient for us to use a common protocol here, so we get interoperability. And then we have to use something else as the differentiating factor to make sure the customers buy our system and not our competitors.
And I think that's really key, that notion of how do you differentiate your service? And it, at some point, it can't be just on the technology, because that's always going to be a race, right? If all of the independent video conferencing companies are trying to both extend their proprietary technologies and provide improved service, they'll never succeed as a solution.
Yeah, for example, if we compare video conferencing with chat services, how many chat service software do you have on your phone? More than you don't even know. In the old days, and with email, and specifically with email, I can just send a message to anyone I want. And to be honest, we could do that to some degree, even when we had X400, because there were gateways in between them. Because in those days, we understood that there is a need for interoperability. And this is what at least I see, and maybe I'm too optimistic with video conferencing, but with chat services, absolutely not. We don't even have a common addressing structure for chat services. Really need to know what system you're going to do chatting with someone else.
Although it's interesting, because some of them have started taking over each other's identifiers, to use the I word, whether it's something that takes over your address book, or whether it's something like, Apple's iMessaging system, which similarly takes over, matches identifiers and connects people, whether or not you know their specific phone number, you can send them text messages, for instance.
Oh, absolutely. And then you have things like Signal and others that actually, and WhatsApp, I think, which actually uses E164 numbers as the identifier that at least used for the original invitation, where you do the sort of negotiation of trust. But on the other hand, then you have other systems which by design do not want to include E164 numbers, but want to have that independence. And then that is that. So yes, you have certain interoperability by inheriting the identifiers, and that's one way of solving sort of that kind of problem. But you still need that kind of very clunky client software that then can talk with everyone. There is one yeah, anyways.
Yeah. No, I know it. And I know it every time. I know I was talking with, you know, I was talking with this friend about that. And she said, I should, you know, do something or other or look up somebody. And I was like, oh, wait, now, was that in Facebook Messenger or was that in a text message? Did she send me email? And, you know, flipping through all the applications, trying to figure out where we were having that conversation, it gets kind of crazy.
And you still see that silos, for example, if you want to read newspapers on your iPad, or if you want to watch TV on whatever kind of device on your smart TV, why should you have, like, the problem here is that if you take the TV situation, you really would like to choose the best client that suits you. And this is where we specifically have to think about also kids or people with disabilities and others. They might have a client that they want to use, and then they want to be able to swap between whatever kind of program they want to see. And we're not talking about linear TV here. We want to talk about be able to buy or use the whatever subscription they have for movies and TV series and whatnot. But no. You have to have one application per provider of the services. So there you definitely see a strong lock-in between the various big players, and also lock-in regarding productions. And no, you don't see Netflix movie on HBO and vice versa. And this will be a very interesting discussion. And specifically when you already saw today when you had... when we do this recording, it's the day after Apple really announced their various things. And of course, yes, they announced the ability to buy a bundle from them. And the question, are bundles forbidden? But of course, they include Apple Music in their bundle. And then, of course, Spotify, which want to compete with just one of the pieces in the bundle, think that might be that Apple is misusing their dominance in that market by creating a bundle that Spotify cannot create. So I think you will see this kind of stress, continue to see that.
So that's even getting into the content layer, which is which runs on applications, which run on the internet, which so on and so forth. And is that where the market is most driven today, from the content side and the bundles and control there?
Yes and no. I think there are different products, and this is where we see this horizontal layering. That you see the carrying of IP packets is one thing. You have sort of the TV distribution, if you take, or video distribution services is one thing, but then information itself is a product, and we should not forget that. And to some degree, we don't really know yet how to handle information, because information, as soon as we started to be able to do digitalization, which basically is you turn whatever you have into ones and zeros, and then you turn it back into whatever you had. That's basically what we're doing. And then with the internet, we can move those ones and zeros, like not only we can move them at any distance without any extra cost, we can also replicate them. But so to some degree, it looks like the production cost for ones and zeros is zero. But on the other hand, the value of information is extremely high, because that is what people are looking for. And that is something that I don't think we have the answer for yet. So the only way to control the information today, I claim, is to control the distribution mechanism. So today, I don't think businesses which actually do make money on ones and zeros don't have any choice, even if they would like to see their information on other carriers. But who knows? If you have... who knows? It might be possible for Netflix one day to license HBO TV series so you can watch both in the Netflix application. Theoretically, it would be possible.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, in part because so much of the business of distribution has traditionally been, you know, geographically bounded, whether it's by getting rights for distribution in given countries, or different countries have different requirements in terms of, you know, in France, for instance, you cannot release a movie unless it is available with subtitling. So if you're a US company making a movie, then, you know, what do you wait on your entire release of the film until you've gotten the subtitling done? Or do you release it 2 weeks later in France, for instance? But, you know, the internet knows no boundaries. No such geographic borders. So how can the business models and rules catch up?
Yeah, and here you actually touch another thing, which I think is really, really interesting. You say that you have different regulation in different jurisdictions or in different geographical areas. Let's call it that. And then you have the internet that don't know anything about those boundaries. So information wants to flow free, which is basically what happens. The problem now with these geographical boundaries, as you say, is that people try to implement those boundaries so you cannot access various things in France or in Sweden that is produced or distributed in US because it violates everything from legislation to contractual agreements. What I think those people that implement those have to do, they have to innovate harder. And the reason for that is that if you look at a household have a certain amount of money that they are interested in spending on information, on those ones and zeros. And if they really want that data, for example, that movie, if they are in France, they will find a VPN or any kind of tunneling service that they will give some money. And that will make it sure that it looks like if they access the thing from the US and they can watch the movie. The problem with that is not only the violation and that they are sort of circumventing some kind of rules, whatever rules they are. The problem here is that for the family, they think still that they pay the total amount of money for the tunneling and the service in the same category as was only the service before. So for the family, you have moved a certain amount of money from the culture sector and production of the ones and zeros to the telecom sector. So you have two different kind of things that are happening here. One, you have competition within the sector where the various producers would like to get as much as the money the household has. But the other one thing you have is a competition between the sectors. And here is unfortunately one situation where the culture sector, where the telecom sector don't even have to fight the culture sector to get more money. The culture sector is giving money away to the telco sector by having those boundaries.
So we're kind of, I don't know if we're on an edge or at an important fork in the road for the internet or if we're well past that. But you and I grew up, you know, professionally building an open internet with open services with a view for all that could mean going forward. And that view is, you know, currently challenged by too many silos, as you articulated in your paper. Is there still a possible future that includes the open internet that we hoped for? And if so, what do we need to do now to start getting there?
I absolutely think that there is that we have an ability to get more openness. I think I'm waiting for example, in the area of IoT, for example, we have lots and lots of things which are not using the IP protocol yet. Think about the building construction code. When you have IP transport to all the sensors in the building, we already have in the households, at geeks' homes at least, you have can control your lights with IP in one way or another. The problem though is that every one of those is a silo. You buy a system from one vendor or another vendor and you have a silo. So that is one example where I wait for the building construction companies, because you have houses which have an average house of age of like 100 years, at least here in Europe, buildings are a little bit older. But let's say like a building is 100 years and then you have to do something serious about them. And none of the communication protocols you use will survive for that long. So the question is, from the building owner and constructor, is it okay with them to buy light bulbs from only one vendor? Or do they want to be able to buy vendors from whatever vendor they want? I don't know the right answer. And the same thing at hospitals. We see that the cost for production at hospitals is extremely high. And one of the reasons is that when you buy an X-ray machine, it only talks with this or that journaling system or that kind of, like, for how long will hospitals accept paying the cost for the intermediaries that can transform the data? And when will they require the vendors to actually interoperate? And so the interoperability, I try to explain interoperability with people that don't understand it. For example, people that run hospitals and stuff, that they have a bed with the number of sensors. They want to be able to replace that bed with a bed from another vendor, and it should still work. That is interoperability. It's the ability to replace something with something else from another vendor and not have a lock-in situation that you buy a bed once and then you're stuck with it. And so I think there are driving forces in the society which will open up some of these things.
So if nothing else, we should just continue to hold up the example of the successes of the early internet development of what can be achieved with interoperability, so that when these different activities and markets reach a point where they've really gone as far as they can as independent silos, we can say, look, interoperability, it's worth it.
Yeah. Let me take another example with houses, for example, with buildings. You have in buildings nowadays, we have more and more electronic locks where you have codes and to be able to get into the building. And of course, a lot of the distribution of boxes and stuff want to be able to get into the building, and you have that all of that discussion. But look at it from emergency, like firefighters or ambulance things. Firefighters, as an average, go to each building once in the building's lifetime, once. And they still need the code for the door for every building in the city. That is logistics that costs a lot of money. They keep Ouch. Track of the code for the doors in a city, but they will only use each door once. That is a typical thing where we need some kind of interoperability. And did I hear identifiers or something? So if we are trying to... So when we do digitalization, we should not digitize an old, inefficient process. We need to come up with new processes that are possible to come up with thanks to IP. Okay. So, and that is really important to remember.
Well, that's good guidance, and certainly gives me more hope for the future than I've had for the future of the internet than I've had for a while. But before we close, I do want to ask you, because I have to say, not many of my friends have been branded an order of anywhere. So tell us about the Order of the Cross of Tierra Mariana, fifth class.
The Order of the Tierra Mariana, which I cannot even pronounce, and my apologies to all friends in Estonia for that. It's something I helped in, like a few other internet friends. I helped with the incident in Estonia when they were under a heavy denial of service attack. And what we did was really, they were really skilled in Estonia as they are, but as they were not known, we helped being proxies and trust them. So when they needed to have traffic filtered, we could sort of announce and help people, yes, this is actually true. We need to cooperate in the world. So a lot of ISPs in the world managed to work together just because we helped. But I have been working with Estonia both before and after that as well. For example, when Skype was created, we did a lot of work in at Tele2 when we bought a provider in Estonia, found some programmers, we did together with Niklas Sandström and stuff, and Skype was created, and unfortunately Toivo Annes, the project manager that we had, passed away just a month ago, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. In the midst of Corona, so not all friends could go there. So there is a small community of that I've been sort of keeping, supporting and helping in Estonia, and well, all of that together, well, I was as surprised as anyone else. And yeah, I feel honored, but I also like the people in Estonia. They are really, really great.
And collaboration, it's the thing. It's what makes the world go around.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Collaboration, that is really, really important. And collaboration, to sort of close the discussion here, collaboration also with your competitors, because it's so important that if whatever you are doing, you must work together with your competitors so that the customer base that you have together don't feel annoyed. So you need to cooperate also with your competitors.
More excellent advice. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast. We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. You can reach us by email, TechSequences@TechSequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this episode or ideas for future episodes. TechSequences. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and subscribe through your favorite podcasting service.